Privacy in Jewish law and halacha is an interesting topic. In a certain sense, it parallels the situation under American law. You listen to things like the Supreme Court confirmation hearings. They want to know what the nominee's opinion on privacy is, the constitutional rights to privacy. If you ever actually read the Constitution, there isn't actually a right to privacy per se. We have a Bill of Rights. We have 10 amendments. That some of them are the right to be secure in one's papers, the right not to be subject to search and seizure. It's not a right to privacy per se, the way it's been understood recent decades by the Supreme Court. But one of the Supreme Court justices famously or infamously wrote about penumbras. The privacy is a penumbra that emerges from the general sense of other rights in the Bill of Rights. As we're going to see in halacha, a very similar situation holds. You will not see the word privacy or a direct Hebrew equivalent in any of the traditional sources. There are, on the other hand, a number, a cluster of related halachas, related doctrines of law, which, taken individually and certain taken together, do form a pretty robust framework for privacy. And, of course, they were not discussing modern technologies, electronic technologies, drones and hacking and whatnot, the ISPs and data and stuff like that. They were discussing snooping and looking through keyholes and listening at keyholes and so on. But as we'll see, there are a set of a half dozen or so interlocking doctrines, principles, and laws which together form the background for discussing privacy. Now, we're going to discuss, as I said, first some of the traditional sources, and then down, as they've been applied throughout the generations, and then down to the more recent applications. So, one of the classic modern papers, for example, written on privacy in Jewish law, is a paper by Professor Nachum Rockover titled "Hahagana al Tzinat HaPrat," the protection on individual privacy. It's a masterful survey of the halachic literature on privacy, yet the title itself, Tzinat HaPrat, is a very privacy of the individual. Individual privacy is a very modern terminology. That's the Mishpat HaIvri project to try to recast classic traditional Jewish law using modern jargon, modern concepts. But as we'll see, it's a fascinating insight into how halacha develops and how it can be translated into modern language. As we'll see, we'll discuss the traditional sources first, going back to the Talmud, down to the medieval sources, and then discuss how they can be applied to modern situations. So in the Talmud, we have several different doctrines, some of which are very legalistic, some of which are more ethical. Different principles, different rules, guidelines that all, as I said, that all aim toward a notion of privacy. One of the most robust is the notion of hezek ri'ya. Hezek means damage, in a legalistic sense, particularly torts and damage caused by someone to someone else. Ri'ya means sight. Hezek ri'ya is the damage that is caused by sight. What exactly does that mean? So, strikingly enough, maybe familiar to those who have studied Talmud, the Talmud never actually defines what it means by hezek ri'ya. The Talmud takes for granted that if I have too much visual access into, let's say, a neighbor's property, that's a problem. So, for example, a famous poet once said, good fences make good neighbors. The entire first section of the Tractate of Bava Basra talks about these regulations for what kind of fences can neighbors demand of each other. Basically, one of the requirements is the fence has to be solid and high enough that neighbors should not be able to see easily into each other's property. That's hezek ri'ya, the entire discussion in the Talmud about it, but this is halacha, this is normative Jewish law. Neighbors can compel each other to contribute toward building a fence to prevent each other from being able to see into each other's property. Additionally, in the later codifications of Jewish law, this has to do with what we would call kind of zoning or the regulations of neighbors. There is a halacha per se, a prohibition per se, against staring into your neighbor's windows. It says, whatever the fence situation is, a fence fell down, you're simply passing by in the street, you see something interesting going on in your neighbor's property, you want to go peek in and see what's going on, not allowed to do that. Now, one of the key themes that we're going to keep coming back to throughout our talk is the modern notion of expectation of privacy. I can look at you right now, just look at the jacket you're wearing, you can't say, private, my jacket, don't look. Obviously, if you choose to wear the jacket and you're in the public space and you know people are going to look at you, you know other people are going to look at you, that's fine. Then in modern language, we would say you have no expectation of privacy. Perhaps we would argue that since you knew everyone would be looking at you and you chose to do what you did, you're not doing anything which you are sensitive toward, which you don't want people to see. And the Talmud itself articulates this argument in several cases when it discusses the need for a fence. So the Talmud makes the point that, well, if what you're doing in this particular position in your courtyard or your home can anyway be seen from the public space, from the public street, anyone passing by can see, then, and you just want to say, well, I want a fence so my neighbor can't see, that's just silly, because anyway, you're not going to do anything private because you're visible by the whole world. So obviously, if you have no expectation of privacy, you can't demand that people build fences, and similarly, probably you can't expect that no one's going to look at you. So the question is where you draw the line. So for example, we always used to debate Hanukkah time. Everyone opens their windows and puts menorahs in the window. Now, we know the reason you put the menorah in the window is so everyone should see it, and they should see Pursue My Nisa, to publicize the miracle of Hanukkah, so everyone should look at the menorah and think Hanukkah thoughts and so on. Yet, if you look in someone's window, you might see other things. You might see his dining room table. You might see his bookcases. You might see his dirty laundry on the floor. You might see whether his kitchen needs to be redone or not. Maybe people are sensitive to that. So are you allowed to look in a window and look inside someone else's house? So again, you can argue on the one hand, he chooses to leave his window open on an angle, the side that faces the street. Maybe he has no expectation of privacy. On the other hand, maybe he expects people to be civilized and not go around staring into his open windows. He knows you look at the menorah, you won't pay too much attention. So this is kind of a gray area, a question of where you draw the line, not entirely clear. Similarly, commonly, you walk down the street, you see somebody's car, you're curious, you see some books, you want to know what he's reading, you want to see what kind of books he has, you want to see other things in his car, you want to just look in the window and see what's in someone else's car. You're allowed to do that. On the one hand, you can argue you park your car in a public street. Anyone can just walk by and look in. You're not going to leave any top-secret confidential papers open there. On the other hand, maybe you do expect that people should behave with some level of restraint, and people aren't going to go deliberately peering inside your car. So again, that would be a question about expectation of privacy. But the basic rule established by the Talmud, again, is that neighbors are required to build their property initially and to erect fences after the fact to prevent the free and unobstructed gaze of each of the neighbors into each other's property, and B, independent of the need to build fences, there is a prohibition per se against looking, staring, ogling into someone else's private domain. Now, why exactly, again, what exactly is the issue? The Talmud never defines it. So in the medieval commentaries, we find several explanations given, all of which I think, most of which at least resonate with the modern era. Some argue that if he knows you can see him, he's going to be constricted. He's going to feel unfree in the way he can use his property. He won't do certain things. He'll be self-conscious. He just won't be able to have the full enjoyment of his property, so you're hindering his ability to use his property. Others argue that the actually seeing the things that you shouldn't see are an invasion of his privacy, the modern notion of invasion of privacy, the idea that he might do something, he might be embarrassed if you know it, it might hurt his financial interest if you see some of his trade secrets. In general, that people simply don't want other people to see what they're doing privately. Some sources bring the notion of tznius, of personal modesty, the idea that people might not always be dressed properly inside the privacy of their home. They might not want to have people staring at their persons at all times of the day. Obviously, there's a difference between a swimming pool, a bathroom, and a dining room in this area, but certainly there are parts of a person's domain where it might not be appropriate from the perspective of Jewish modesty to have people staring inside the house. It's also the notion of ayin hara, the evil eye. We're not going to get into that. But basically, most of the doctrines of Hezekiah have to do with the modern notions of privacy, the idea that a person will either be hurt by having someone see everything he does, or that he'll simply be constricted in how he can use his property. These are the main notions of privacy which the commentary cites in explanation of the Talmudic rule of Hezekiah. And again, the basic rules are you have to, A, construct the property in such a way that there are elaborate, complex rules to what this requires exactly, how the houses have to be built, and how the yards have to be built, but B, without getting into all those details, there's a particular prohibition against looking into someone else's domain without permission. Now, there's an interesting debate among some of the medieval or early modern commentaries about Hezek Shmiya. Hezek Ria, again, is a Talmudic term. It means damage caused by sight. What about the analogous Hezek Shmiya, damage caused by listening to each other? You can overhear, you can eavesdrop. There was a classic version of this question that came up in the 16th century, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. He was asked again about neighbors. One of them, they were going to put up a fence, and the situation was they couldn't see. But the question was, they could overhear. One of the neighbors actually wanted soundproofing. Now, obviously, if he wants to put in soundproofing at his own expense, that's fine. But he wanted, just as the Talmud says, neighbors can force each other to contribute toward a fence that'll block sight. One neighbor wanted the other to contribute to a fence that would help damp or block sound. So Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi ruled, nope. He took a kind of conservative, narrow interpretation of the law. He said, Hezek Re'iyah is a thing, Hezek Shmiyah is not a thing, there is no Talmudic precedent for it, and therefore it is not a claim that is actionable under Jewish law. And this is also a theme, a kind of Supreme Court nominations again, a kind of attitude toward the law, which we're going to keep coming back to, which is, do you take a very literal, narrow attitude toward the law? The law says what it says, halacha says what it says, the word used is re'iyah, vision and sight, that's all we have. We do not extrapolate and extend to other types of privacy issues, and this, of course, is going to be a major issue when we get to the modern questions about electronic invasions and other things. Do you say, that's not what they said? They said sight, they said letter, they didn't say email. This is an issue we're going to come back to again a couple times, but this is, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi takes the narrow view, Hezek Re'iyah Shamanu, Hezek Shmiyah Lo Shamanu. Yes?
Strict construction.
Yes, strict construction, very very literal, words.
You might go into damage caused by smell.
Right, damage caused by smell, right. That's the idea. We take a kind of strict construction, the kind of original intent. Words mean, words don't evolve. They mean what they meant when they were initially propounded, and we don't extend it to sound, to audio. Rabbi Menachem Meiri, an earlier authority, he says he also arrives at the same conclusion that there is no claim in general for neighbors to build soundproof walls, but he gives a somewhat different explanation. He doesn't make a formalist, strict constructionist argument. He simply says that people he gets back to expectation of privacy. He says when people talk, they generally have no expectation of privacy. If they talk in a normal tone of voice, it can be overheard by anybody else. They generally have no expectation of privacy, and therefore there's no need to build a fence. The implication is that if a person is talking in a situation where he does have an expectation of privacy, and you somehow manage to overhear anyway, you have one of those spy microphones, or obviously you want to wiretap his phone or something like that, that the implication would be the Meiri would agree, would concede there is an idea of Hezek Shmiyah by analogy to Hezek Re'iyah. He just says that in the normal default case, at least the normal default case for the 14th century, then a person typically who spoke out loud had no expectation of privacy, but he seems to concede in principle there is a halachic problem of Hezek Shmiyah in much the same way that there is a problem of Hezek Re'iyah. Now, again, that has ramifications today. For today, we do have ways of eavesdropping on someone who's talking. We have ways, technological means, there'll be other means of eavesdropping on someone who does have. Even in the Meiri's time, you could have a case where someone didn't realize anybody was there. You happened to be sleeping, hiding behind a curtain or something. And again, the Meiri would argue that there is a problem of Hezek Shmiyah, just as there's a problem of Hezek Re'iyah. Many contemporary authorities rule that even Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi would agree with this. He just, when he said formally, Hezek Shmiyah lo shamanu, no such thing as Hezek Shmiyah, he just meant because there's no expectation of privacy. But he also would agree, and this is, I think, the consensus view, that not such a literalist, not such an ultra-strict constructionist view. They said Re'iyah, but they were concerned about privacy. After all, what was the problem? The problem was they were concerned about privacy. Privacy concerns clearly apply to overhearing audio, too, and insofar as there is no expectation of privacy, the consensus of later authorities is that the Talmudic concern of Hezek Re'iyah would apply equally in the form of Hezek Shmiyah, in a form of eavesdropping on spoken conversations. That is the main Talmudic discussion of privacy, the doctrine of Hezek Re'iyah. As we'll see, there are other sources which go back to Talmudic and even biblical sources, but this is in terms of the well-developed body of law, this is really the main locus of classic Talmudic discussion. The attention now shifts to the 10th century or 11th century or so, to a very terse but very powerful edict of Rabbeinu Gershom Ar HaGolah. Rabbeinu Gershom was a legendary figure shrouded in myth and legend, but Rabbeinu Gershom was a legendary figure around the turn of the previous millennium, about the year 1000 or so. He was the founder of the Ashkenazic tradition, one of the main founders of the Ashkenazic tradition of halacha, of culture. He is famous largely for promulgating a whole string of edicts. They are called charamim, cherims. Cherim literally means a ban or an anathema for our purposes, these were basically solemn enactments that were made under penalty of cherem. He basically legislated, as we would use the word, he enacted a whole bunch of post-Talmudic rules to mostly to ban certain types of conduct that he felt was inappropriate. Now, it's important to understand that it's not always clear when he banned something whether that thing would have been permitted until then and he therefore had to change the rules to forbid it, or whether he was sometimes simply strengthening a pre-existing prohibition, and that's going to become important for us soon. But nevertheless, he instituted a whole string. There are, as we'll discuss momentarily, there are maybe a half dozen really famous ones. There are dozens more that are less famous. But he instituted a whole bunch of bans against various conduct that he considered inappropriate.
Well, it was just a question. On the string, did he do the one with
Chalitza?
You don't have that anymore? Or that was not?
No, I'm not sure. We'll get to that in a minute. But okay. Just to discuss... Right, just to discuss a few of his famous ones that many of us are familiar with, he was the one who banned polygamy, probably his most famous one in Ashkenazic circles. He was the one who banned polygamy for Ashkenazim. The biblical law, even Talmudic law, a man can marry multiple wives. He banned the practice. That's why Ashkenazim have not taken more than one wife for 1,000 years. Sephardim were more ambivalent about accepting it. Some Sephardic communities did, some Sephardic communities did not. Over the years, it became less and less common even among the Sephardim. But this is probably his number one most famous ban.
There could be other good reasons not to do that.
There could be many good reasons, right? Winter points out, not to marry multiple wives. And indeed, that's what we're going to get to soon. Rene Gesher himself wasn't making mysterious rules. Most of the rules he promulgated have very good reasons, most of which we can understand. He also banned unilateral divorce. He said divorce requires consent to both parties. One of his most famous bans, relevant to us today, is, again, it's very brief, and it's about 8 words long, and we should also note that we don't really have the original text of his bans. There's a lot of analysis of the exact wording, but the wording is mostly centuries later. It wasn't really written down, and it's in a precise form. At least the sources we have are not till centuries later, the later medieval period. He had a ban against reading someone else's mail. The words are something like a cherem against opening someone else's mail that was sent from someone to someone else. That was pretty much the language of his man. He banned intercepting and reading mail. Now, halachic authorities debate many, many questions about the exact scope and nature of his ban. One of the most basic questions is exactly why did he ban reading mail? We could probably think of lots of good reasons: privacy concerns, lots of reasons not to allow reading someone else's mail. But throughout the halachic literature, we find a number of different reasons proposed for Rabbeinu Gershom's ban, and it's not always clear when the poskim give these various reasons. Some of them seem to be reasons that would stand on their own as prohibitions that would have existed on their own. Rabbeinu Gershom just came to add the power of a cherem. Some of these reasons, as we'll see, seem to be much more ethical principles, kind of extra-legal principles, which might be difficult to construct a real prohibition on from them, but Rabbeinu Gershom solidified them and codified them and made them into a formal halakhic ruling. Yes?
How long was the ban for?
Good question. We'll get to that soon. So, just to discuss some of the reasons given by the various commentators for Rabbeinu Gershom's ban, one of them is, this is really aspirational, but one of the reasons is, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, famous verse in the Bible, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Klal Gadol b'Torah, Hillel famously said, this is the core of the Torah, everything else is commentary. So you should love your neighbor as yourself. You wouldn't like it if someone went around reading your correspondence, so don't read someone else's correspondence. Now this clearly would seem to be something which was just, again, I'm using the word aspirational, a kind of general guiding ethical principle. It's difficult to argue that this would automatically yield a binding halachic prohibition before Rabbeinu Gershom came along. After all, why do we need a Shulchan Aruch? Just to have one rule, v'haftal recha kamocha. Who needs law? Who needs halacha? Just be a good person. The answer is, of course, in the real world, there are very often clashes between my interest and your interest. Not everything that someone doesn't want someone else to do is prohibited. For example, if I have a business, I would rather nobody compete with me. But first of all, that might not be fair to the consumer, as we've discussed in the past elsewhere. Second, he has a right to make money too. So I may not like it, but that doesn't mean I can stop somebody. V'haftal recha kamocha can't just be used as a blanket rule to say nobody can do anything that I don't like. First of all, because that would yield contradictions. Second, because that's not the way the law or halacha work. So to just construct a prohibition based on v'haftal recha kamocha is not so simple. Rabbeinu Gershom apparently felt that in this particular case, the the conduct was so prima facie bad that it falls into a category where we should ban it.
Throw in
the same Tov, a winter points out there's another biblical verse that you shall do righteousness and good. You should walk straight. You should do the straight thing and the good thing, which in general is invoked by the Talmud and by the commentators as an exhortation to go beyond the letter of the law. So yes, these would be reasons. They might not be reasons to actually forbid it on its own, but these are reasons why Ben Gershom might have chose to ban it. Another reason given, and this is a very interesting one, is that it is considered a form of theft. That a person, the Rabbi Chaim Shabsi, a leading 16th century Sephardic authority, said that the owner of the correspondence, the sender probably, has an ownership interest in the letter. If you are intercepting it and reading it without permission, you are committing a form of theft. Now, this is open to two interpretations. We find different later commentators understood this in two different ways. Some seem to have understood theft means the physical medium in which the information is contained, like the physical letter. That letter is not yours, and if you steal it, then your unauthorized tampering is stealing the physical letter. Others seem to have understood a much more abstract, much more powerful rule. It is the information that you are stealing, that the information which doesn't belong to you, by accessing that information without permission, you are stealing the information. This is something, of course, which is controversial, but a very powerful concept if you accept it. The question is, does halacha have the notion of the ownership of intangibles, like of data, of information, data to use the modern term? This, of course, is usually relevant when we discuss intellectual property, things like copyrights and patents. The question is, can you own an intangible thing like information? There was a fascinating debate in the late 19th century. This was actually not really what we would call a copyright case. This was more a plagiarism case. What happened was somebody published someone else's work, someone else's Torah as his own, and took credit for it. Now, it wasn't a question of commercial infringement. There wasn't even a claim being pressed by the original author. The original author didn't object, it seems, or wasn't around. The original owner was not pressing an ownership claim. But the question was, the community was outraged that this guy had committed plagiarism. I just saw a headline this morning. I think Neil Gorsuch now is being accused of having plagiarized in his thesis. Nobody gets away with this. In the internet age, everyone gets caught sooner or later. I don't know what he did, whether it's anything more than we all do occasionally to half accidentally borrow a sentence from somewhere.
Wikipedia.
My mother's an English professor. She. This is the bane of her existence, constantly. The problem is, there's a lot of gray areas, obviously. You can quote. You don't always put full quotes. If the idea is good, what are you supposed to do? You need to quote the idea. You have to attribute. That's the key, obviously. Sorry?
They'll find something.
So this was apparently egregious plagiarism. The fellow had ripped off responsa, letters that were written to him by greater rabbis than he was, and he passed them off as his own work. And the rabbis who were discussing this were outraged. So the question is how to define plagiarism as a halachic category. What did he do wrong from a Jewish law perspective? So one of the issues they raise is theft. By taking credit for someone else's work and passing it off as his own, he's stealing. Now, one issue of theft is he's stealing the public trust. That's another issue. But besides that, he's stealing the property, the intellectual property of the original author. Now, this is not so simple because, as I intimated earlier, when you're dealing with plagiarism, plagiarism can be with the full consent of the original author. For example, and my mother has to deal with this, there are services out there that'll sell you a term paper. They're very happy to let you use their paper as their own. You pay them, and it's a perfectly valid business transaction from their perspective. Now, obviously, you're committing a fraud against the college, against the public, against your future employer, against a lot of people. But the point is, the intellectual property holder, you may not be guilty of theft or not, but the point is, this is taking us far afield, the point is, there is a lot of debate whether halacha has the kind of intuitive notion of theft. And even today, there are raging debates about this. Many, many pedants like to argue, no, intellectual property violations are not theft. It's a separate statute, which is true, but the idea behind it is theft to some extent. So this is a question as to whether halacha has the notion of theft of abstract notions like information. This comes up in a very interesting and seminal debate among modern dayanim, modern rabbinical judges. There was a case in Israel, a couple of cases in Israel. There were messy divorce cases, and the husband wanted to introduce as evidence recordings he had secretly made of his wife's conversations with someone else. Apparently, he felt they were damning. There was material in there that he felt would help his case in Beis Din, prove her faithlessness or prove her bad faith or something that would help his case in the Beis Din. And her lawyers told the Beis Din that they should be not admitted as evidence because they were improperly recorded. You have no right to record personal conversations.
Well, she didn't know they were being recorded.
Yes, it sounds like she did not know. It sounds like he secretly recorded her conversations. And so again, in the United States, I think it's a state-by-state thing. Some states require consent of both parties to a conversation. Some states allow consent of one party. I don't know what the laws are in Israel. This is probably 30, 40 years ago. Also, whatever it was, we'll stipulate that these recordings were made against the law, perhaps against the halacha. She wanted them blocked and not to be admitted as evidence. And his side said, you know, where is there anything in the Torah? Let Beis Din decide whether it's relevant or not. If it's relevant, it should be accepted. If not, not. In America, we have these doctrines of fruit of the poison tree and so on, that if you commit some crime, at least if the government does, by breaking the law to obtain evidence, then certainly the government can introduce it as evidence. But halacha has no obvious problem with this. So the question is, this was the question that the Beis Din had to address in one or more than one case. Is this recording indeed, did he commit an avera, a sin, by doing it? And B, should it be admitted to Beis Din? We're interested here primarily in the first part of the case. Is there a halacha, a Jewish law, that was violated by the recording? And the poskim do generally answer yes. The rabbis involved generally assume that he has indeed sinned by doing this, and they invoke many of the same principles we've been discussing. We will be discussing violations of privacy, hezek shmiya, shol shlomidas, theft of property. And here the theft issue is very interesting, because unlike in a letter, a physical letter, you know, they used to have paper. People used to take pens and write things on paper. I saw it in a museum once. People did that sometimes, but you know, they used to be actual papers. So back then, if you took a letter, you were stealing a physical object. But today, listening to a phone call, you haven't touched any tangible property; it doesn't belong to you. If there's an issue of theft, it's going to be the information, the conversation itself. So they actually raised this question. Some understood expansively that there is a notion of ownership rights and property, and therefore you are committing theft if you illegitimately, without consent, access that information and certainly pass it along to another party. Others said, no, halacha doesn't really have such a notion. But in any event, the rabbis in question did say the conversation was improperly recorded. However, as I said earlier, there is no real notion of fruit of the poison tree, so he may have to repent and ask her forgiveness and pray to God to forgive him for what he's done. But if Beis Din fails, information is relevant, they will still accept it. They will still accept it in the case. So these are some of the issues Rebbeinu Gershom had in mind, perhaps. V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love thy neighbor as thyself. Theft, either of the physical medium or of the information. Another very interesting idea which comes up is the idea of tale-bearing and gossip. The Torah says, lo selech rochel ba'amecha, thou shalt not walk as a tale-bearer among thy people. Normally, when we talk about rechilas, about evil speech, about gossip and slander, the idea is, I tell you information I know about a third party. So I'm conveying information to you. That's what we think of as gossip or slander or evil speech. But there is an opinion that maintains that even if I simply read the speech about you, I don't convey it to anybody. There are only two people involved. You have your secret diary. I go ahead and read it without permission, or your letter, I read it. I don't tell it to anybody. That's also a form of gossip and slander. What's the difference if I tell it to another person or if I simply read it myself? In either case, the person about whom I am reading or communicating or conveying information is hurt by the...
It says selech. I mean, it means that the information's moving.
See, your argument should only be selech from me to somebody else. Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely a novel interpretation. It's not, you know, the point is a valid point. Nevertheless, so, and again, whether he really means...
It's not
that
the information that the Torah says in the selech. It's the rochel.
Yeah.
The gossiper.
Right, so you make a similar point to him.
No,
I mean,
disagreeing with that.
Okay.
The selech is not mandating the information. It's talking about
the gossiper means gossip by its very definition, I think, usually implies I convey information via gossip. Yeah, we can debate whether he means you actually violate the prohibition itself, or whether he means that there's a Jewish value and a halachic ethic we derive. But either way, that's another issue that inherent, whether directly or just in a general sense, in the prohibition against gossip, is the prohibition is a problem with accessing somebody's private information. Yes?
Yeah, I was thinking that. So if someone were to give information and it would be false information, misinformation, or damaging information, are we in the same ballpark, or then we moving into more like Lashon Hara?
Well, if it's false information, it's going to be even worse in certain ways. You know, to falsely slander a libel is going to be much worse. Whether you also violate this, I didn't access it from him, I just made it up myself. Are you also violating this prohibition or not? Interesting question. I'm not sure.
Also, the other interesting thing is that a third party actually heard the wife say this to a certain extent. He has to come to Beis Din for aid.
Testimony, right.
So that's the undoing of Achilles.
Right. There is a dispensation for a testimony. Returning to a point somebody raised earlier about, is the cherem still in effect? Is there a duration for this cherem? Getting back to Rabbeinu Gershom's edict in about the year 1000 or so. So no one really knows. As I said, we don't have a first-hand primary source recording of what he actually enacted. With regard to some of his other cherems, the one about polygamy, for example, there is a tradition that first appears several hundred years later. There is a tradition that says that he only instituted it ad sof elef hachamishi, until the end of the fifth millennium from creation. Today we're in the year 5777, according to the tradition, so that would have expired some 700-800 years ago. So there are those who say that cherem is no longer in force, and some say by extension that applies to the cherem against intercepting correspondence too. On the other hand, Post can make a number of caveats and counters to this. First of all, many argue that there is no such thing, that there's no source for this, that the cherem does not have any sunset clause. And even if the cherem of polygamy does, that was where the Rashba recorded this tradition that it only applied till the fifth millennium, the end of the fifth millennium. Some say that was only polygamy, which the Torah has no problem with. We don't find any real criticism of until much later. But Rabbi Yehuda Herzlankin argues this in his Tshuvos Bnei Banim. He says something like, reading correspondence, which is wrong on so many levels, and we have Afrecha Kamocha and Rechilas and all these other problems, even if Rabbeinu Gershom added to it with the Cherem, the practice is so reprehensible and so undesirable anyway that there's no reason he would have made a sunset clause. So some argue that there was no sunset clause. But in any event, it is debatable whether the Cherem still applies or not. But everyone agrees that many of these other prohibitions would still apply.
Was Rabbeinu Gershom, his takanas really accepted by Sfardim?
So we touched on that briefly earlier. Some of his takanas were definitely not, like the polygamy takana. Even that, many Sfardim did accept it. Some poskim say the default was that by default Ashkenazim did and Sfardim didn't, but they acknowledge that many Sfardim communities did. In any event, even within the takanas of marriage, some were. So, for example, some say that the non-unilateral divorce takana was much more widely accepted than the polygamy takana. So I don't think I saw that much about this particular takana, whether it was accepted or not. And one could argue it would be necessary to establish that this one too applies to Sfardim. So that would be an interesting point. If you're Sfardim, many of the classic sources who discussed the cherem actually were Sfardim, so it seems that many of them did. Although again, you're right. It's not immediately clear that all Sfardim accepted the takana.
Why would anyone set a sunset period for any?
That's a good question. So no one really knows. Just as nobody even knows for sure why he made these enactments, nobody really knows. Some argue that he wanted to kind of emphasize and distinguish between biblical or even Talmudic rules, which are permanent and indefinite, and his own, which were of a lesser severity, especially when it comes to polygamy. The Torah explicitly allows it and countenances it. So he didn't want to completely rewrite the Torah.
But is there a precedent? I think, was that your question? Is there a precedent for it?
For sunsetting takanas?
Is there any other?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think there might be some, although I have to think through it more carefully. So it's a good question.
Personal cherem. I mean,
how many personal cherem
would they be?
Yeah, I guess you wonder if even drabbanans we ever find these kind of sunsets. An interesting question. Now, turning back for a moment to expectation of privacy. So as we mentioned earlier, in the context of Hezek Shmiah, of eavesdropping on audio, one of the key questions is expectation of privacy. And this comes up again in regard to the Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom, with regard the 18th, 19th century authorities discussed things like, if someone sends a postcard, a Geluya, apparently it's called in Hebrew, an open letter, an unsealed letter. Some poskim argue, some authorities maintain, that there's no expectation of privacy. If you send it open, you know anyone can read it. So again, either you won't put anything private or you just don't care if your private things are read. So then there's no problem in someone else reading it. Others argue, particularly in the modern situation, postcards are not really accessible to the public. They'll be accessible to postal employees, obviously, if they choose to read them. And if they put them in an outdoor mailbox, somebody can come along theoretically and open it. But that would be kind of shady behavior, and you wouldn't expect people to be rummaging through your mailbox. And you know, there are crimes against tampering with the mails and so on. But some postkim have argued that, no, that we should not assume that there is any loss of expectation of privacy just because someone fails to seal his mail. And a similar question could really be raised with regard to email. This is, again, very topical. Your email passes through a whole bunch of steps on the network between you and its recipient. It goes through your internet service provider. It goes through the recipient's internet service provider. If he's using a webmail service like Gmail, it goes through Gmail's computers, Google's computers. It goes through backbone providers, L3, whatever these companies are that connect the different computers. So it passes through a number of different corporations. It passes through all kinds of there are all kinds of different engineers, system administrators.
If it's encrypted, that's like it's sealed.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We can discuss encryption. I'm talking about classic email, which is not encrypted through many steps of the way. If you talk to Gmail, it might be encrypted on that leg, but when Google passes it along to Yahoo, let's say, or to Hotmail, it very likely is not encrypted in transit, and certainly many older email protocols were not encrypted. So yeah, you're right. There are
scanning all the emails.
Right. Google itself is obviously reading them. At least the machine is reading them. So the question is, again, do you have an expectation of privacy on email? You know that there are many steps along the way that it could be read. On the other hand, as you're pointing out, on some steps it's encrypted, and even when it's not encrypted, most of the serious companies have all kinds of privacy policies that limit which random engineer and employee has the right to just go rummaging through your email. So maybe there is an expectation of privacy. So that, again, would be an interesting question about the...
Not to mention the NSA.
Right. And the other aspect Ray Winter is raising, which I wanted to get to also, is... In these days, in these interesting times, there's always an expectation, to some extent, of governments reading your email. There are some paranoid people always thought so, and then the paranoids turned out to be largely correct after the revelations of Mr. Snowden. And every day, barely a day goes by before without us hearing new revelations about what's going on exactly, who's reading what. My wife is a federal employee, so you know, for a year I was getting notifications every month that another group of Chinese hackers have now sucked out all our databases. Here's another free year of identity monitoring to make up for that. So that my wife always says, they have our social security numbers, everything else, and at least six different divisions of Chinese intelligence by now. But so on the one hand, some people have just thrown up their hands and says everyone has whatever I have anyway. On the other hand, you don't really expect that. You expect a few intelligence services do, but you hope that the secret forums on the dark web are not like freely trading your social security number. I mean, unfortunately, some of them are. Some social security numbers have made it out to the general criminal underworld. But again, it's hard to know what people really have today in terms of expectation of privacy. We just had these rules that my boss is very worked up about the Republicans deciding to allow the ISPs to freely sell a lot of your browsing history. So again, on the one hand, people have less and less an expectation of privacy than they ever had before. Another aspect of this question, even going back even a while ago, is the question of your company, your boss. The traditional rule has always been that if you do anything on your office's network, their computers, their network, they have the right to scan everything. And the law, I think, explicitly establishes that you have no expectation of privacy when you're using corporate systems. So does that mean your boss freely has the right to just rummage through if he's bored to look at who you've been emailing and what you're buying and your medical, which doctors you've been visiting, and have you seen a urologist lately or anything else or not? Yeah, so again, most people do have at least some fragmented, little worn expectation of privacy left. On the other hand, they have a lot less than they used to maybe. So that raises an interesting question about what the expectations of privacy are in today's day and age. Haven't seen much serious discussion of this. It's an area that requires further discussion by contemporary, hopefully tech-savvy poskim. Another related issue to the email question, really to the old letters too, is that when we talk about intercepting correspondence and it's a violation of privacy, whose privacy are we concerned with, the sender or the recipient? So we mentioned earlier, some poskim say that if you send a postcard, an unsealed letter, then the sender has shown that he has no expectation of privacy, so anyone who wants can read it. Well, what about the recipient? Maybe there's information of his that's private. And some poskim indeed say that that's a problem, that you cannot read postcards for that very reason itself. What about the reverse case, though? Some of the earlier authorities say that if someone discards a letter, discards it in a public place, then anyone can read it because it's no longer private. Well, maybe the recipient doesn't care. What about the sender? Maybe he cares. You can argue that if the recipient discards it in a public place, he made the judgment that there's nothing private in the letter. I mean, if you trust his judgment, yes. But the question comes up, a very, very common question in the digital age. The question comes up, you receive an email from your friend. You would like to forward it to another friend, to your brother. Do you have the right to do that? So that's a letter. It was sent to you in confidence. And who said you have the right to forward it? So again, you're the recipient. You don't care. Maybe we have to be concerned with the sender's consent. So this is something also which different halakhic authorities come down in different places on. Are we primarily concerned with the sender, with the recipient, both of them? There are definitely opinions that come down on both sides of this. And it would seem that simply forwarding an email, you know, I do it too sometimes, but it's really not a simple thing. Truth is, I've gotten in trouble for it. I've had people occasionally who became aware that I forwarded their email, and they were upset with me. Obviously, I had made a judgment that there was nothing really harmful in the email, nothing really personal, but you never know. No two people are the same. People's expectations of what's sensitive and what's private and what should be kept in confidence are very often not the same, and I've learned the hard way. You know, I haven't made any major faux pas, but I've learned the hard way that it's very, very dangerous to substitute your assumptions about what should be private than someone else's. Arnie mentioned to me earlier, reminded me of the Talmudic dictum. It says, Lamar, the Torah uses the word Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe, Lamar a lot. That Lamar means tell somebody else, in one understanding, that the Talmud says, anything someone tells you by default, you do not have permission to relate to somebody else unless the sender explicitly authorizes it by saying Lamar, by saying pass it along, by saying tell someone else. And some halakhic authorities specifically invoke this with regard to correspondence. Even the recipient has no right to show the correspondence to anybody else, Lamar, until the sender has authorized it. He has no right to do it. And the truth is, just again to underscore how easy it is to make a mistake. Sometimes someone sends you a joke, and the joke has been forwarded to him by somebody else. You know, it's a joke that's circulating around the internet. What harm could there be in forwarding it to somebody else? Yet I've had someone complain to me that he's embarrassed that now the recipient knows that he's reading silly jokes and that he's on silly websites, and he's embarrassed to have someone else know that that's where he hangs out on the internet. So you really never know. This would be a serious issue. I don't have concrete guidance on this one, but this is really an issue. It's so easy to forward email today by just hitting forward. Not a simple matter, according to halacha. Now, one of the themes we've touched on several times today has been strict constructionism versus a more evolving notion of what the word should mean, what the law should mean. And this actually comes up with regard to Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom's language, as recorded again by later authorities, was in the 12th century, 13th century, was the Zecherim against Liros Biksav Chavera, to see a letter that was sent by someone else. So some argue that should equally apply to email, it should equally apply to telephone calls, because what was Rabbeinu Gershom concerned about? Privacy, invasions of privacy. Well, today we do things by email. So email contains the same type of information as letters do. Same thing should apply. Others argue, no, words mean exactly what the original authors meant, intended them to mean. Ksav, to a man writing in the 11th century, did not mean email. Email is not ksav. Phone calls are not ksav. You can actually distinguish between, phone calls and email. Email, you can argue, is fundamentally ksav. It's not ksav with a pen, but it's letters. It's written language. It's recorded. It's alphabet. The same language they spoke. Not exactly the same language they spoke, but close enough. While phone is completely different. Audio is a completely different mode of communication. So some of the posts, when we say it doesn't apply, we're referring largely to phone calls. But others argue, no, even phone calls, they argue. Rabbeinu Gershom was concerned about the interception of personal communication. People can, all the reasons of rechilus, of gossip, of theft of information, of hatorecha kamocha, all these things apply equally to other types of communication too, and therefore many authorities do argue that these prohibitions should apply, even Rabbeinu Gershom's cheirim applies to other forms of communication also.
Yes, so that was the point I was making. The word you use for writing an email is ksav.
Right, right. You write an email, right. True, and that's, you know, that's a valid point, yes. Yes? Send an audio by the post. Yeah, the fact that you sent it by the post, I think it would still retain its character as an audio tape. If you feel that any communication is included, it'll probably be included. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Would it change the fact that it was sent in the mail? Just want to turn to one last point to finish it up. There is debate also in contemporary authorities about whether the cheirim can be violated in extenuating circumstances. Various posts can discuss things like schools, schools want to monitor the correspondence of their students, or especially if they know there's a problem, they know a student is having inappropriate contact with someone who could be dangerous for the student even, so they... Now, again, you can distinguish between general monitoring to just be big brother over all the students, and you can distinguish between a case, you know there's a problem, you know a girl has been having trouble with somebody, somebody might be a predator, and you want to monitor a specific case of correspondence. The Post can discuss commonly the latter. There is a famous, you know, wickedly funny story. I don't know if it's true, it's apocryphal, it's probably not true, but it's very funny, and it ties together some of the themes we've been discussing. There's a story about a student, an adult student in a yeshiva, and the head of the yeshiva apparently was monitoring his correspondence, and this is back in the day where they didn't have phones, and you know, letters took time to get there. The student was away from home, and he had left his wife behind, so the headmaster calls in the student and says, congratulations, I heard your wife... I heard your wife. I read a letter from your wife to you, and I saw that your wife reports that she gave birth to a child. So the student asks the headmaster, "Which wife?" Then I have more than one. So the headmaster says, "Look shocked." He says, "You let her have more than one wife? Didn't Rabbi Gershom say only one? You're not allowed to have more than one wife?" So the student says, "Well, didn't Rabbi Gershom also say that you're not allowed to intercept correspondence written to other people?" So the story is apocryphal. It's probably more of a joke than a true story. But the point is the headmaster presumably felt that he was justified under this general school or good intent dispensation against that allows the intercepting of correspondence for the benefit of the students. He's in loco parentis. He's supposed to be keeping an eye on the material and spiritual welfare of the students. And some posts can actually allow this, although, again, usually in more limited circumstances. Similarly, in the harem of polygamy, the ban against polygamy, there were some authorities who allowed polygamy in a case of mitzvah. You know, for Yibam, some poskim allowed it. You mentioned chalitza. Some authorities allowed it for other cases of certain other cases where there were issues of mitzvah. Many others didn't. Some authorities argue that for mitzvah reasons there is a dispensation. Others say no. Others say that prohibition is a prohibition. You can't violate Shabbos because you have good intentions and you mean well, and you can't do other things, and you can't just...
Yeah.
It's not the same. It's not the same because many B'nai Machavera prohibitions are, you can override them. But there are debates on other ones too. So, for example, Post can debate whether you can confiscate property from a student for, you think it's for his educational benefit. Some Post can say no. Some Post can say theft is theft. Again, here you have the questions of expectation of privacy. A person concedes, certainly a younger children, parents of younger children concede to a school the right to do some level of monitoring. But again, there is some debate about whether the cherem could be waived or suspended in the case of a well-meaning school administration. So in summary, we have three levels of privacy protection. We have Talmudic ones, where Hezekri and Shmia. We have Rabbeinu Gershom, who made a ban against intercepting correspondence, and there is some debate about how broadly or how narrowly it should be interpreted. And then we have a whole family of related prohibitions, theft of the medium or of the information, and V'avtal Recha Kamocha, and Lamar of not repeating things that were told to you in confidence, and the gossip, L'Selek Rachel, not so clear all of these stand on their own, but these are all certainly the complete unanimous consent of all postcom is this is a bad habit. Some postcom explicitly say, even if you fall through the cracks in between different prohibitions, it's not technically prohibited. Excessive nosiness and curiosity and meddling into someone's business is not appropriate. And therefore, the Post can all agree it's a bad habit and should be avoided, hacking, eavesdropping, intercepting mail and electronic communications. As to whether you actually violate these various prohibitions, we've discussed some of the basic debates, many of the basic debates that apply to these various forms of accessing information without permission of the author or the recipient or the people to whom the information should belong.